How many steps do you take before you have foot pain? Hi, it's Jonathan Cotton with the Good Feet Store, and the truth is, the battle between our feet and the concrete or asphalt usually winds up with our feet losing. Studies show that about 75% of people will experience some kind of foot pain by middle age. I found that out a number of years ago with plantar fasciitis, and I tried to remedy it with shoes and drugstore cushions that didn't work. Finally, I went to the Good Feet Store, was personally fitted for arch supports, and I love them so much, I bought the store. Without a plan to protect and support your feet, it is likely you could one day be one of the millions living with chronic foot pain. Don't wait until pain demands that you visit us. Stop by the Good Feet Store today and let one of our trained arch support specialists fit you with your personal system of arch supports.
The Good Feet Store is located in Fairfax, Leesburg, Rockville, Baltimore and Hunt Valley, and in Annapolis in the Annapolis Harbor Center. For more information, go to goodfeet.com.
Took me away from my home in Abilene. I was sworn I'm a soldier now. I was trained to survive. And from a boy I became a man. We journeyed to a place called Nam. Spent 13 months of living in fear. They say it's over, but I'm still here. Hey America, can you hear me? Don't you remember me? Hey America, can you hear me? Why don't you set me free? Hey America, can you hear me? Don't you remember me? Set me free. I ask myself as I sit here alone, if there's a chance I'll ever see my home. I pray to God every night and day, but help has never come. I'll keep my faith as long as I'm alive, hoping America will hear my cry. We are the last of your forgotten sons, the ones you've left behind in Vietnam. Hey America, can you hear me? Don't you remember me? Hey America, can you hear me? Why don't you set me free? Hey America, can you hear me? Don't you remember me?
Welcome to today's Story of the Sacrifice, American POW MIAs. This is kind of our first episode of Cambodia POW MIA chat. Well, episode one with David, the MIA Hunter McMillan. I'm your host.
Hey, how's it going, everybody? Can you hear me clearly?
Hear you great, Dave.
Oh, great. That's great. Hey, everybody. Yeah, it's Sunday here. So, Shabbat Shalom. And a lot of people here are off to church or they've just got back from church. But, yeah, bless everybody. Bless everybody out there. Bless all my brothers in the service in the United States. This is the DMAC over in the Sunshine Coast in Australia, keeping it loose. Thank you for inviting me onto your show, Mr. John Bear.
Oh, great to have you. So
cool.
Yeah. How do we want to kick this off, Mr. Dave?
Well, essentially we have some information that was disclosed publicly on YouTube that was related to what I would characterize personally believe as the when I recovered the remains of Taizo Ishinose. And we kind of touched on it last time, but there's a video on the internet that's speaking about our operation. And so you and I are going to have a look at that video and we're going to have a little bit of a chat about it and respond to it.
Yeah. Give us a little, just a quick background on the video for people that might be listening. So it was kind of a quick background on what you were doing, what cases you were working on and
okay. No worries. So starting back in 2009, I started to work as an investigator for the family of Sean Flynn, specifically Rory Flynn and their family representative, Mr. Mike Luring from California. And in 2010, March 14th, 2010, I recovered the remains of a MIA in Kampong Cham, Cambodia, in a village called Pakar Dong. I was looking for the bones of Sean Flynn, the famous American B-movie actor, son of Errol Flynn, and Lily Demeter, who was a famous journalist who had went missing. But we'd known from the beginning when we went out there on that operation that it was a 50-50 chance that there's going to be a Japanese and there's going to be a Caucasian. So we recovered the Japanese remains and the Caucasian remains, as you and I have been speaking about, of the prisoner were recovered and identified back in 2003. But that was held in the same area, the Caucasian. There was a Caucasian and a Japanese prisoner held. And I recovered the remains in Kampong Cham. I was reporting to the US Embassy all the information, what we were doing leading right up to the operation. And then we recovered the remains. And then independently of the embassy, and then I handed the remains over to the embassy. But there was a huge... there was a lot of press about it. And at that time, there happened to be a journalist reunion, the first and last journalist reunion in Phnom Penh and also in Saigon. And so when the news came out about the fact that we'd found the remains of a missing journalist, it was also coincided with the 40-year reunion for all the journalists from the war. And they'd come back to Southeast Asia for the first time. And they all found out news that... the remains of an MIA reporter had been found. So it created like a very huge like press tsunami worldwide. It was in the news of the world. And David Letterman had a joke about it. It was like a whole bunch of really crazy stuff happened related to it. And since that moment, there's been, we found out in June 2010 that it wasn't Sean and that it's a Japanese. So it's been like a 10-year struggle for me to work out who it was that we found. Now I'm certain, even though we haven't done the DNA comparison yet, the US government hasn't completed that yet. I know from all of the preponderance of evidence that I found Taizo Ishinose or Ishinose Taizo, the Japanese citizen. But in the pursuit of me trying to identify this man and repatriate his remains, I have hit like a wall of a bureaucratic wall, and people are reporting on something which is very positive, which is me finding the remains of an MIA. For me, as a individual in Cambodia to find the remains of one of the missing reporters, it was the first time that there'd been any evidence found of any of those missing reporters since 1993. And so it's taken a long time for us to work out who it is that we found, but the final hurdle is to identify this guy. And some people have said before, like, you know, this is kind of a conspiracy that's just in your head and all this type of stuff. But if this was just something that Mike Luring and I had dreamt up, there wouldn't be all the press about it. And people wouldn't go to the extent that they've went to create this video that we're about to look at. So I just want to...
Yeah, it's been said that you were just a bone hunter out there trying to make a buck, you know, and
yeah, well, that's the thing. Like, you can't make any money doing like what we were doing. And it's a humanitarian pursuit. And if anybody who knows me, since I was young, I haven't made a fucking cent. Like, I don't mean to be rude. I don't mean to cuss, but I'm not the type of individual who does things that's related to money. Like, I'm one of those individuals that does stuff that's related to like humanitarian things and like honor and shit like that. That's my thing. That's my, not everybody is wired that way, but that's the way that I've been wired. So like Mike Luring and I, we've been helping the families, and I think you understand this, like that when you're working with these families, it's a very precarious situation. Yeah. As you know, my grandfather's MIA, so it's made it easier for me to be involved with the whole thing, but and to relate with families, because I've carried the same trauma as they carry, because everybody who's been in that situation, as you know, is generally the same. As you were saying before, when you're speaking to people, you can't, you know, it's, you don't have a political opinion when it comes to this thing. Like, it's not a blue state, red state thing. It's a American thing. Missing Americans is an American issue.
Exactly. And just before we jump into this video, you know, here's the actual proof that you guys turned the remains over to the it's the Joint POWMIA Accounting Command, back then JPAC, but it's now Defense POWMIA Accounting Agency, and that's the report on the remains that you guys had found. Anyway, we'll jump into that video here.
No worries.
Let's see here.
USA.
There we go.
All right.
Let's turn that up so everybody can hear it real good.
Yeah, cool.
Spirits out there tormented. By that time, another chapter.
This was done by Star News 365.
And closed. In March 2010, two men, described by the press as bounty hunters, declared that they had found the remains of the missing photojournalist. Unlike Page and Young, they were not connected to the missing men, and their heavy-handed approach was widely criticized. Apparently untrained in forensics or excavations, the two men, a British bar owner and an Australian explorer, had focused in on a remote location in eastern Cambodia. According to The Independent, they were led there by reports of the execution of a man matching Flynn's description. In a sinister twist, one witness claimed that the prisoner had been forced to excavate his own grave before being killed. Confident that they had hit on Flynn's final resting place, the two men assembled a team of locals and began digging at the site. But for Paige, who believed...
Well, I just want to point out, that was not your excavation.
No, but that's a pretty good file image that they used there. It looks like I just dug up Siem Reap, like the Angkor Wat temple. That's a pretty amazing picture.
Right. I just wanted to point that
Getty
out.
Images, baby.
He said several murdered journalists could be buried there. The act was tantamount to desecration. Meanwhile, the bounty hunters' attempts to exploit their story for financial gain did little to endear them to Flynn's former colleagues. Despite criticism, though, the two men did succeed in retrieving human remains. Could Flynn and Stone finally be put to rest? Unfortunately for those seeking closure, that was not to be. In June 2010, a spokesman for the U.S. military announced that the bones did not belong to the missing photojournalist and were likely those of a Cambodian local. After the controversial excavation, it seems, the site in eastern Cambodia was locked down by the Pentagon's Joint POWMIA Accounting Command. To people such as Paige, this was an encouraging development. Indeed, McClatchy wrote, "Maybe now my friend's remains will be properly found and identified, and they'll be safe from scavengers." So far, though, no trace of either Flynn or Stone has been recovered from that site or anywhere else.
All right.
Yeah, so I just want to say, like, you know, the amount of work that it takes and the amount of risk that it takes to go out there and do what we did and to come up with remains. The people that criticize me, the thing that they don't understand is they never came up with remains. They didn't come up with remains. They didn't dig into the ground and pull bones out by themselves. And I'm not being critical of the people who've been before me, but Zalen Grant, Richard Lynette, and JPAC dug the fuck out of Cratche. They found nothing. They came up with some little bits and pieces of cassava root that they thought were bone. They weren't bone. They didn't find anything. They dug the hell out of there. Tim Page spent years digging things up. As I said, Tim Page never actually found remains. He purchased remains from a bone trader in Sankei Kong village that had dug up the remains back in like the 80s, and there was some remnants of some teeth with some fillings in there that were there. Those fillings, I have the documents, those teeth went missing. Some Welsh dental expert lost it. And then the way that it was, that the US government worked out that it was Clyde McKay that was in Sankei Kong, was they did like a mop-up operation, and they went and they dug up in Sankei Kong and they found small bone fragments, and then they tested the bone fragments and did the mitochondrial DNA sequence or whatever, and they got a hit, and it was Clyde McKay. So
Well, let me back you up here a minute too, because you know, you're talking about how nobody ever dug anything up or anything like that, or they didn't even follow up on actual intelligence or firsthand witness accounts of this execution that you actually
you can look at Turner Classic Movies, and you can see Deidre Flynn speaking about this on Turner Classic Movies back in the 80s when she's being interviewed about what happened to her brother. And she's saying, we've got this document from the Pentagon saying that he was stoned to death somewhere in Cambodia, that he had to dig his own grave and was stoned to death. This stuff has been reported for years. As you know, if you have a look at the Library of Congress MIAPOW files or the CIA files, this stuff pops up straight away. The Flynns for many years believed that from the 80s until when I did my dig, the Flynns had believed from the reporting that Sean and Dana had been killed in Pakat Dong. They'd been stoned to death. And there's a Turner Classic Movies interview where Deidre Flynn is saying, my brother's death was a ghastly thing. He was buried alive. That's even long before I was involved in the case. So also, I want to say a really good book, if you want to know all about Errol Flynn and Sean Flynn, is Inherited Risk by Jeffrey Meyer. Have you read that book before?
I haven't, but I've heard of it.
Oh, man, it's really brilliant. What it does is it compares Errol's life with Sean, Errol's life in Hollywood in Papua New Guinea with Sean's life in Vietnam. But it's a brilliant book. And inside that book, it also came to the conclusion that Sean was stoned to death in Pakat Dong. That book was published in 2005. So this is 5 years before my excavation. But the amount of work that it took to recover those remains, the fact that these guys keep on saying that it was a desecration. This person was lapidated. He had to dig his own grave. He was lapidated. They took all of his belongings off him and tied him to a post in the center of the village like a dog before they took him out there to dig his own grave. When they took his boots off him, he cried. He had a Christian cross around his neck too, this guy, the Japanese guy. So, you know, what happened to this guy was horrible, and there was probably never going to be any evidence of him retrieved. And I retrieved evidence of it. And from retrieving evidence of this individual and of the horrible war crime that was committed against this person, I have had my reputation destroyed by these dickless people that I never saw out there in the jungle. I never saw any of these guys giving service beyond what they'll paid for, a lot of these people. And this is about money, because you and I both know as researchers that Clyde McKay was held in that area and most likely Taizo Ichinose. But there's books that are printed out there that say in detail that it was Sean Flynn and Dana Stone. There's famous books out there. So it disproves a whole bunch of stuff, and it makes people lose money. And I'm not trying to make money. This is the thing. No, what you mean to say is you stumbling upon this evidence was history and groundbreaking. And what it does is, if we recognize it, is these are.
You know when you order a new video game, or a golf club, or a blender, and then it arrives at your door, you get a little thrill. Imagine how much more thrilling it is when you order a new car. With Nissan at Home, you can shop for the perfect ride and order it without ever having to go anywhere. Sure beats a golf club or a blender. Buy a new car entirely online with Nissan at Home. Deliver direct from dealer to driveway. Thrill starts here. Services may vary at participating dealers, subject to applicable law. See dealer for details.
I haven't really woken up until I've had my McDonald's breakfast deal. And I know this is true because before breakfast, I put my phone in the refrigerator and couldn't find the keys that were already in my hand.
Nothing gets the morning going like the first sip of an iced coffee. Get any size and any flavor for 99 cents until 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. McDonald's, I'm loving it.
Rip-off merchants. These absolute rip-off merchants who've made a buck out of this story, out of the bullshit, out of their poorly researched rubbish over all of these years. They don't want to recognize that we found ties that we should not say. They don't want people to know, because what it does is it makes them lose money. We weren't looking for money from anybody. It makes them lose money. So just me doing my humanitarian work made them lose money. How could I desecrate the remains of somebody who was stoned to death? As you know, John, all of the US DIA and Pentagon reporting says that this person was stoned to death with huge rocks that were from a local pagoda that they went over there and they did their due diligence on and worked out that they were the same stones. So how can you desecrate that? How can you desecrate someone who's been lapidated? When you bust somebody up with those stones, like the amount of pressure, how many thousands of pieces do you think their bones are going to be fragmented into when you're smashing them to pieces with rocks? Yeah. There's going to be not many pieces of them left. And lapidation makes sure that all the evidence is gone. It turns a person into mincemeat. So what are the chances of finding somebody after they've been turned into mincemeat by stones and lapidated? Well, the chances of doing it are very, very slim. But for whatever reason, it was my dumb luck that I found these remains. So, yeah.
Especially that many years later, and that any remains that were left out in the ground, you know. It's now going back to that video, they also said that the remains they said the remains belonged to a local Cambodian, and I kind of beg to differ on that, just based on the evidence that you were dug up. And you want to talk about this?
Yeah, sure. So you can see there's a dental abutment, what we call an osseous there. So you can see that the synthetic material in those teeth is very high quality. And the person that went missing out there, that was killed out there, we know that it was between 1973 and 1974. So the person who had this type of osseous, dental osseous in their mouth, at that time, it was unusual because of the quality of the dental work at that time. The quality of the synthetic material, often the mouth would reject the synthetic material when it came to a dental osseous. So sometimes it like lasts 7 years, 8 years or something. But in Japan in the 60s, they worked out how to make this osseous that wouldn't reject. And there was about 30,000 of these operations done between 1960 and 1965. And the quality of the porcelain in these teeth, it's Japanese quality. And the steel, it's Japanese material. And you can see below the teeth, below the osseous, there's a hole drilled through one side of the jaw to the other. It's like a drain because of this operation. And if you look at the photographs of the Japanese journalist Taizo Ishinose, he had scars over his face in the same place, and he had dental reconstructive surgery on the same side of his face as we recovered the portion of his jawbone. And if you overlay the jawbone onto the photographs of Taizo, it matches the scarring on his jawline. So yeah, we have a lot of tentative information. We have there's a 66 page document that I put together that has a lot of the DIA reporting concerning Taizo, but and not just Taizo, concerning, there's a lot of reporting concerning an unidentified Japanese individual that was an MIA. So once we knew about this unidentified Japanese person for a long time, but yeah, as I said, it took me many years. It took me to meeting Kong Vaughn, the man who helped Ishiyama and Ishinose cross over to the Khmer Rouge, for me to understand that it was Ishinose and Ishiyama were the main candidates.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts and your feelings about, just, I know you kind of expressed it a little bit ago here, you know, just having them come out against you like they have. I mean, there was, you want to talk a little bit about, I don't know if how deep in the weeds you want to get into that when you're at that.
Well, you know, it's just like, you know, that people used to talk about fake news. It used to be a common thing, fake news. Well, I experienced this early on. I didn't really particularly know what was going on in the background, but I knew that something big was going on and all this weird stuff was happening. And now after I've lived through it, I understand that fairly early on, it was worked out by people that were in the know that I'd found Taizo Ishinose. So there's been all of this stuff in the press about me for years, blocking this and a whole bunch of crazy stuff, trying to discredit me. They said all this crazy stuff like we were doing Lord Byron type of things, like we had the skull above the bar and we were drinking alcohol from the skull, like Skull and Bones type of stuff, you know, just really crazy things. It was like, let's make up the craziest and most disrespectful thing that we can say, like, about the situation, and we'll just always stick to those talking points. We'll never speak about the relevant information that this guy presents, which is actually US government information. It's not the US government that's screwing me around. It's not them at all, but it's these journalist guys who don't want the truth to get out there about what actually happened to their colleagues, because if the truth gets out there, they feel like they can no longer cash in on it. That's it. That's the right. Only a very famous photographer that they made a movie about in the 80s, and that there was a Academy Award related to, he told me, like, I don't agree with those particular journalists. I'm not going to name them. I don't agree with their bullshit, but I'll tell you one thing. The Japanese guy that had the combat boots on, that was Taizo Ishinose. I knew him. And this journalist said to me, and I didn't know what he meant at first, but he said, and hey, he wasn't like you and me. He ain't no fellow traveler. He was no fellow traveler. So this journalist, this famous American journalist, was telling me that he was a commie, pretty much. But yeah. So there's a whole bunch of people in the know that have told me that I found Taizo, and that has been covered up. And that Kong Vaughn, you see that interview with that guy in Phnom Penh, he and I had a discussion and he was blocking me. And then at the end of it, him and I became friends. And then he just spilled his guts about Taizo. Like, I didn't know. He told me about it. I didn't know. So now that I know about it, I know people get frustrated with me, like shouting it from the bleachers all the time. Like, I found Taizo. But, you know, these guys, there's people out there that have lied about it and have went out of their way to discredit my work, all of the work that I've done related to MIA POW people in Cambodia, and all of the work that I wasn't after money for. I was volunteering my service to do stuff that nobody else would do. And you say, why were you taking, what do you mean you're taking chances other people weren't taking? Well, other people weren't prepared to take the chances that I was taking in Cambodia with field work, because they didn't have insurance that would cover it. and I did stuff without insurance. I didn't have insurance. I didn't have any. I rarely had money in my back pocket to get me out of the situation if everything went to shit either. But I just do it because, like say Mike or Rory would see, we would see that there's an opportunity for me to look into something related to Sean that could be promising, and say it's in the dry season, we've got a window to do it. Boom, I had to go in there and do it. It wasn't like I was getting paid for my downtime when I was in there, or I was trying to make any money. It's not like you can make any money out of finding, particularly make money out of finding the remains of people, unless it's like your career with the government. As I said, we were doing things at Sparrowhawk Global. We were doing things on the side over in Cambodia related to MIA POWs with GPR. But yeah, the US government, they do the great work. They're the heavy hitters. And this whole beef has got nothing to do with the US government. It's got to do with a whole bunch of foreign journalist people from Britain and maybe some from America, some from Australia, definitely some from Australia.
Yeah, they're just looking out for writing books and getting money off book sales from what I've been seeing. You know, it's...
Yeah, exactly.
It's not like you're out there on a free vacation, I'll tell you that, because that would not be a vacation with what you were doing.
Yeah, and we did everything in small footprint. Like, it's not like we had any of the infrastructure that the US has, like Stony Beach. The regular Stony Beach guys and the regular JPAC guys, they have helicopter time, and you know, when they're doing their operations, they fly in and out into the different villages and helicopter. They don't go in by car all the time, so when it's serious anyway. So yeah, well, we were just traveling around light.
One of the things that really upset me when I was really digging deep into this case was some of these guys were, you know, going behind your back and talking bad about you to the Stony Beach and to the DPAA. You know, yeah. It's
well, if you have a look at, that's a thing though. The thing that's cool about it is if you have a look at the reporting from the DIA at that time, Stony Beach, it says stuff like, these guys have been criticized for doing something which was like a desecration, but we looked into it and they didn't do such a bad job. So that's an interesting thing. There's some people out there from certain agencies that have said negative things, but there's always been positive stuff from the Stony Beach side saying like what these guys did wasn't so bad. Like if we can work out how to do this and get results, and like if we can control this type of thing, it's not such a bad thing. Like it's a proof of concept, essentially, what I did, finding those remains. Because and then, you know, we took it to the next level, Michael Henshaw and I, with Sparrowhawk, with ground penetrating radar. But yeah.
I found it pretty interesting, though. You know, I ran into a document here the other day, and I'm not going to, you know, say what it was, what the document is. But anyway, it was a journalist that was writing about another journalist that was conducting a search for Sean and Dana Stone. Sean Flynn and Dana Stone. Well, anyway, at the very end, this journalist went out on his own away from the DPAA teams because he thought, you know, the remains were located somewhere else. So he dug his own test pits by hand. And at the end of the day, when it was all over and he didn't find nothing, his only response to the whole thing was, "I wished I would have got a backhoe too."
Oh, cool. Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. I didn't think that I was going to find the remains. And if you have a look at the footage of me beside the grave there, like before we found those remains with the burial location, I won't say a grave, because this is the thing, like if you say it's disinformation to speak about somewhere, a location where somebody has been lapidated, where a crime scene, to refer to that as a grave. It's not a grave. It's a burial location. It's not a grave. It's not like there was flowers on there or anything like that. They smashed his body to millions of pieces.
That's true. So, it's a sad deal. There's a lot of those all over Cambodia too.
Yeah, but it's fake news and disinformation, and the chances of us unearthing that type of evidence was very low, but we unearthed it, and we have plenty of documented evidence to provide to people that we found something. Even in that video, it says that they found something, but then it diverges and says, oh, it was a native Cambodian. It wasn't a native Cambodian. There were no Cambodians that had that type of dental osseous in their mouth at that time, I could tell you, especially out in that area. As my friend Scott Brantley always says, he said, Cambodian with that type of dental work, what? They only have a bag of rice and an AK-47 out there, really. That's pretty much all those guys had. They had like peasant pajamas, a bag of rice, AK-47. A lot of them didn't go to school, but I mean, there wasn't people running around with that type of dental surgery in their mouth in Southeast Asia at that time, or even in the world, maybe in some places in Europe, but it was specifically coming out of Japan. And now, because, you know, we've had Chinese manufacturing for such a long time, we forget about how in the old days, how the Japanese ruled the roost when it came down to making synthetic material. Yeah, high quality stuff, like pumping out high quality things and solving things, you know, solving problems like medical problems, like an osseous rejecting itself. Well, the Japanese are the type of people that would develop the steel and the porcelain that the mouth would not reject. So
right.
Hence the osseous, the dental osseous. And in that document that you put up on the screen earlier, you could see that it's a very detailed piece of dental work. It's not basic. Yeah. So can you read
it's hard to read. I can't blow it up.
Okay,
if somebody's full screen on there, they can read it.
But okay, so I can read it, man. No worries. So it says Joint POW MIA Accounting Command, CIL 3460, 14th July 2011, Memorandum for Casualty Office for POW MIA Civilian Department of State, subject Rory Flynn's request for information. This memo summarizes the identification efforts related to JPAC ZIL case number CIL 2010-031, a purported U.S. citizen. The following information is provided about the case. 2. The skeletal remains include a partial cranium, partial mandible, partial right humerus, probable humeral fragment, cranial and long bone fragments, and a small amount of minute bone fragments. Laboratory analysis has determined that the remains are those of a probable late adolescent or adult mongoloid male with no apparent trauma. Well, no apparent trauma. He's been stoned to death. Oh, shit. stature cannot be determined due to the paucity of the remains. So it means we can't work out how tall he is because he was lapidated. 3, the dental remains consist of a right mandibular lower jaw fragment with the presence of teeth 28, 29 and the mesial root of tooth 30. Teeth 31 and 30, with the exception of the mesial root, are antemortem missing and perimortem postmortem missing teeth 26, 27 and 32. Teeth 28 and 29 are restored with preformed, not custom made for the individual teeth, non-precious metal crowns. Both of those crowns are splintered together and are the mesial abutments for a four-unit bridge, which is a fixed prosthesis. The design of this prosthesis and the materials used does not reflect standard dental practice techniques in the US. Well, no shit. It's been in the ground for 42 years in Cambodia. So, we haven't had time to update everything. So that's how it works. So there's no antemortem dental evidence record available. So there's no they don't have dental records for these individuals, apparently. Thus, it's not possible to perform a dental comparison. 3 skeletal samples, a temporal, mandible, and humerus, were acquired from the remains from mtDNA analysis. All 3 samples produced that same mtDNA sequence. This sequence is excluded from all reference available for comparison from the entire Vietnam conflict. In addition, the sequence does not match any sequence in AFDIL's casework population database of 10,428 individuals. Comparison of the sequence to the phylogenetic tree of global mtDNA variation suggests that it may belong to haplogroup M25, a poorly documented branch known from South Asia. So if you have a look into it, M25, this particular haplogroup in Asia, it comes from Kyushu Island in Japan, and the Okinawan Islands, the same place where Taizo Ishinose originated. So number five, all conducted analysis concluded that the remains, CIL 2010-031, are those of an unidentified probable male individual who originated in South Asia. That's not Southeast Asia. South Asia, that's Japan or Korea, right? So in addition, the dental work is not similar to contemporaneous dental practices in the United States, but it's because it was done in Japan in like the 60s.
I have been fed, that's a fact.
I have been fed, that's a fact.
My credit card purchases get me cash back.
My credit card purchases get me cash back.
No one else gets these rewards.
Sergeant, that is just plain untrue.
What in tarnation?
Sir, PenFed's PowerCash Rewards Card isn't just for military members. Anyone can get cash back on all purchases.
Ah, figgins! You've ruined my favorite song.
PenFed Credit Union. Visit PenFed.org/PowerCash. To receive any advertised product, you must become a member of PenFed, insured by NCUA.
Everybody needs just the right amount of fuel to get going in the morning. For some, a nice McDonald's egg and cheese bagel is just enough to do it. Others might prefer a McDonald's bacon egg and cheese bagel. Or perhaps a sausage egg and cheese bagel. And there are those where nothing will do but a hearty McDonald's steak egg and cheese bagel. Four different breakfast bagels to get you going. Tomorrow morning, give your engine a head start at participating McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Yeah, and I'd like to add here recently, and since I think 2017, 2018, 2019, they've done extensive genetic research on that haplogroup now too. So it fits right in with what your thoughts are that it might be him. So,
well, I just think that, you know, it's the chances that an analyst hears this and thinks, hey, I might be able to bring home a dunk for the United States. You know, some of the guys in the DIA, they might get awarded more rising sun honors from Japan if we can do this, if we can get this guy back. And what these guys are talking about online is, it sounds like a noble pursuit. It doesn't sound like the end result of what these guys are working at is some sinister agenda. They're just trying to get somebody laid to rest in the correct way. And it's been a very long struggle, but that's my dream in this. I hope that an analyst can pick it up and have a look at it. And it's my belief, and I think you probably share it after the fact that we've been speaking about this and going over all the research together, that there's a good chance that the US lab could get a dunk on this, a slam dunk, a big dunk.
They could. I think the only thing that's really holding them back right now is the United States government's policy on conducting anything to do with a foreign citizen. So they, you know, in most cases, the DPAA won't even look at it because he's a foreigner.
Yeah, right. But as it said in the thing, that the remains that were handed over to the U.S. Embassy in relation to a probable American at that time. So even though we've determined that it's not an American, hey, we follow the protocol. I'm an Australian. I handed it over. I did the correct thing. I handed over the remains. We did everything in a civil way. So it's unfortunate that there's so many different governments involved because of the way that this is split. When you think about it, it's like what I'm trying to do. You need the Cambodian government, you need the Japanese government, you need the American government, you need the Australian government, you need the Commonwealth government, right? You need all of those parties to come together to do the right thing.
That's right.
And yeah, I don't know. I don't like the chances on that. And it's not me being critical, but it's just the way the world is. Like, as I said, I found these remains, and I'm a punk rock singer from the Sunshine Coast in Australia, and people didn't expect me to find the remains. And then, like, for example, how it hits home here. My uncle, he lives out in the country. He's a hunter and stuff. And his mate's got a huge property out there. And his mate gets all these magazines mailed out to his property. And there was this military history magazine, Australia. And there's an article, this is 2010, there's an article about me finding these remains. And then on the other page, there's an article about Simon Bolivar, right? So, I mean, like, my uncle had a clipping of this and my family kept it, like, they framed it like it was like a big thing and stuff. But I mean, like, the reporting on this, it went like very wide and very far. And the initial thing was people jumped at it trying to say that we'd found Sean Flynn. And this was at a time when News of the World was like still going before they were shut down for all of their spying. Essentially, they were an espionage network and they were shut down for like illegally accessing celebrities' phones and stuff like that. So these guys who took this idea that it was Sean, like it was possible that it was Sean. We were looking for Sean, but we didn't know. We had to wait for confirmation from the lab. And that confirmation came in June 2010. Bye, Mum. Sorry, my mum's off to work. We had to wait for the confirmation, but that didn't stop the British press from running with the story and making some elaborate, that they just referred to me as an Australian explorer. Like I think I've said before, like we haven't referred to somebody as an Australian explorer since like 1800s or some shit, 1850, since there was guys with their bullet-drawn carts going across the interior of Australia and disappearing and stuff like that. We haven't had Australian explorers.
Right. Oh, shoot. So, what's the next steps for this case here on this set of remains for you? Where's this going?
I don't know. I think probably the only way that I can go with it is, to make a documentary about it. And I have all the evidence and stuff in it, and it's going to make a very compelling documentary. But I have to continue to work on this case to try to resolve this case, and I'm never going to give it up. So I've told my friends that are close, that work with the government and stuff, that it's not a threat. It's just me telling them straight up, like, this is something that I'm not going to give up. It's a bee that's always going to be in my bonnet. Like, I want to, and it's not like it's a horrible thing that I'm trying to do. I'm a working man. I'm a family man. I'm on my P's and Q's. I do right by my community. I work as a COVID marshal, which means I suck it up. Like, I'm like, I have no authority and people can just wail on me all the time, but I do it because I'm helping my community. And it's the same thing as the things that I've done before. Like, I love to do service for my community. And when I did this thing over in Cambodia, I was thinking in the back of my head, this is a thing that people in my country don't realize. I was thinking, like, you know, my head was loaded with all these ideas about lofty ideas that I was taught in school in Australia about like accomplishing shit and like things that have been taught in the United States about accomplishing things. And that's how I got there. It wasn't by like any sinister agenda. I'm just like anybody else. I was just trying my hardest and I had no resources, and by chance I succeeded. And because of that, that scares people, some particular people, it freaks them out. And it shouldn't freak people out, because I'm just trying to do the right thing by everybody. And I accomplish this thing in my lifetime, regardless of if they take my life away or they try to discredit my work. I've accomplished this thing in my life, and I owe this to Taizo. You know, it could be the shoe that this is just like karma, the way that the world is, but the shoe could be on the other foot. Just think about it. If I was born in 1940 and then I went missing and then Taizo came and picked me up, found my bones, I'd expect him to fight for me like how I fought for him.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. One of the people in the chat there, it's Sue from Lucky Dogs production moderator. She's asking, what got you into becoming an MIA hunter? You want to just give a quick background on your grandfather?
My grandfather was a career soldier, a Scottish Highlander soldier, one of the They used to call him the Germans used to call them the ladies from hell. He was a kilted soldier, and he served in Afghanistan and Pakistan and India. And then he came back and he was killed on the Maginot line, pretty much in France, Belgium type of thing, in the very beginning of the Second World War. And because he was killed at the very beginning of the war, there wasn't much information about his death. So he was carried as missing in action for about 8 years. And then during that time, my father was very small. He was only about a year old when my grandfather was killed. So my father spent time going to invalid hospitals throughout Europe, trying to find his father with his mother, all these people that were blown to pieces and, you know, disabled guys from the war, trying to find his father. And it was very traumatizing for my dad. And then, so my dad grew up, he went and joined the services. Dad went into the Navy, but he wasn't allowed to go into the army because his dad was killed in the army and his mom didn't allow it. So yeah, my dad went into the services and then he came out to Australia. My dad's Scottish and had a family. And then when I grew up, essentially, you know, your dad just kind of levels with you about where it's at and how your family got to where it was at. And, you know, all of this stuff when I was small was all about my grandfather, who was MIA, and I had all of these things related to him, and he was missing. And there's this strange air over him, like this mysterious air over my grandfather because he was missing. And then when my dad moved to Asia, and then my mom and dad broke up, and then I went over to see my dad, and then I connected with dad, and I decided I was going to stay in Asia. And then dad introduced me to some people, some Australian guys who owned a security company. And then those guys introduced me to some American guys. And the American guys that I was introduced to, they were all like former JPAC, former JTF, US mortuary affairs soldiers that had served in the 90s, and they were coming back on holiday and stuff. And they're trying to set stuff up, like career path stuff, like contracting companies and stuff, military contracting companies. So these guys, they met me through my father and started to introduce me to their world of mortuary affairs and the training, joint operations, mortuary affairs stuff, and like a traineeship type of thing through the company Sparrowhawk Global and Sparrowhawk Far East. And so these guys, they trained me with all these particular things. And then in 2009, I started to report to the US Embassy in Cambodia for Rory Flynn with things related to Sean. And then through that, at the end of that reporting process, I found the remains of this Japanese guy. So after I found these remains and all of the news went all around the world, there's particular people in America, in Arkansas, that had MIA family members that were very well connected in the POW MIA community, ride to the wall, wounded warriors, but all the MIA POW League of Families, all of these guys who were kind of a little bit estranged from the conventional US government process of looking for their siblings and stuff like that. This was before, everything's been reformed now, and there's not so many complaints by families and stuff, but there was many more complaints before. So a lot of those family members, they contacted me and they said, hey, we've read all this stuff about you. Can you help us look about this case about my brother? Hey, here's my friend Linda. Can you look into this thing about her brother who went down in this helicopter crash and they could only recover his teeth? Like all these people started to contact me. And then my father, who lives in Vietnam, who was retired at the time, he was like, okay, let's mount up and go out and go looking for these people, Jimmy. And that's what we started to do. And then over the years, like through my work with all of the American guys that I was working with through the company and through the embassy and stuff, I just started to get into everything deeper with them, and I started to do more work over in Cambodia. So between 2016 and 2018, I did a lot of MIA POW searching for US personnel in Cambodia during the time that the official operations were down. Michael Henshaw and I were doing a lot of things in conjunction with the Documentation Center of Cambodia. And if you want to have a look it up, Mr. Yuk Chang from the Documentation Center of Cambodia, he was awarded a Ramon Magsaysay Medal at the same time that he was working with Michael Henshaw and I, which is the Human Rights Nobel Peace Prize of Asia. So Michael Henshaw and I were rolling with some human rights heavyweights at that time as well with our research. There was a lot of hope, even right up until the end of the Khmer Rouge trials, that there something else was going to eventuate from it. But it seems like there's no more legal human rights crimes to be prosecuted in Cambodia. And then now it's more going to be more about the process of healing. So like if you have a look up now, Yuk Chang has started these genocide centers, which are like museums all around Cambodia, started to do some very positive things. So yeah, so that's how I got into it. That's pretty much it. And I came back here to Australia in November 1st, 2019, and I've been back here for 2 years now. And yeah, it's great to be back in my country. I know that we get a bad rap overseas, and that we've been laughed at about being a little bit too totalitarian. But I assure you, it's really not as bad as one would think.
You talked about so this is going to kind of bring me into the next.
Okay,
I guess for lack of. The next phase of things here.
Yeah.
We want to do a couple, kind of like a little mini series here on just Cambodia and the MIAs and stuff. So you were talking about how you investigated other cases just besides, the Flynn and Stone and some of these other journalists. Yeah. What other cases did the US government have you looking into?
I looked into the Jerry Shriver case out in Mamot, and Michael Henshaw and I worked on that case. We looked at the specifics on that case, and as I've said it before, and I'll say it again, I believe that if Sparrowhawk Far East, if we were given the opportunity to take a run at it, like as it was planned, but it didn't eventuate, if we're allowed to take a run at that case out there in Mamot, I think that within 2 or 3 days we will get results if Jerry Shriver's buried out there. But that's pretty much about how efficient we've got with the process with the GPR, John, because essentially, as you know, with all these cases, the US government, they have like specific GPR coordinates on these locations where they think people are buried. So with our process with Sparrowhawk, we come into an area and the area has a whole bunch of vegetation there. So what we do is we clear all the vegetation, and then we cut all the ground back and let it dry out for a couple of days. So it's all like baked dirt, the top of it. And then we do the survey. And if it's under there, the GPR is going to give us the evidence that it's under there at what depth. We'll have all of the specific information. And we can tell people whether or not there's something buried at that location, or if there's nothing buried at that location, because we know the difference between what something looks like and what nothing looks like. So like with the Shriver case or with any specific case, most of the cases that I was given to work with were in Tebum Kumum, which is in Kampong Cham, the same area that I found Ishinose Taizo's remains. So I was working many cases in that area, Ratanakiri, Mondal Kiri, the Cochrane and Laker case up in the hills there. I think it's either, I can't remember if it's Mondalkiri or, no, yeah, Mondalkiri. And I've looked into some of the stuff up. There's some cases up in Ratanakiri up near the Lao border, like air crashes and stuff like that as well that I was working on. But with me, there's two bees in my bonnet, as we say with the Scottish, the two bees in my bonnet. One is, I want to identify Ishinose Taizo and I want him to be repatriated to Japan. And then also I want to find the remains of Jerry Shriver. So people say to me, hey, when you come back to Asia, are you, you know, what are your plans? What do you want to do? If you come back to Asia, why will you come back to Asia? If I come back to Asia, I'll be coming back to go looking for Jerry Shriver first, go looking for his remains first, and then, I don't know, have a look around, continue doing what we've been doing over there. Because yeah. Our process, it works. Our process is our process with the GPR, it's non-intrusive. Essentially, it's non-intrusive. We can work out the depth of where the target is, which is the human remains, without disturbing the soil on the top of the surface. So the things that I was criticized about before by using an excavator, which if you look at the Mortuary Affairs Joint Operations manual, it tells you to use an excavator in the same manner which I used it, which is to take the surface, slowly scrape the surface by surface, and then we hit rock. And once we hit rock, you can see in that footage, John, I pulled the rock out of the ground and it sucked all the water, a big water hole sucked up underneath there. And that's where I started pulling the skull out of from all under there. So it's really miraculous that we found the pieces of Ishinose Taizo that we did, because that guy had been, he'd had probably about one ton, maybe, you know, like 1,000 kilos of weight or more in individual packets dropped on top of his body.
Yeah.
Before they covered it up with soil. So we're lucky that we found anything, but it's that strength of that synthetic material that, that portion remained. So
yeah. What is the Japanese government saying?
There hasn't been any dialogue. And so I haven't really spoken out before about this stuff. I just kind of suffered in silence about it and let everybody lie about it. I can't alter the things that they're saying. In the world that I was working in before, with looking for missing people, and this is all related to you reporting things to U.S. Embassy, right? This is all related to intelligence. So in the intelligence world, people weaponize things and they weaponize disinformation against people. And that's just part of the game. So as an individual, I've had people say a lot of horrible things about me, but it's been weaponization of disinformation. And because, as I said, there's people out there that don't want to recognize me for this. Well, my boss before, Order of the British Empire, Dominic Scriven, mate, he's an economist and he has an Order of the British Empire. He was my boss. He's the reason essentially why I have the cut of my jib is the way that it is. Okay, this guy, he has an Order of the British Empire for creating economic opportunities in Vietnam. I found the remains of Taizo Ishinose. So in theory, if it was any other Australian, if it was somebody who went to the Australian National University and had a good education and stuff like that, and didn't come from like the hillbilly mountains, wasn't a hillbilly Australian rockabilly singer who can argue with you crazy Americans from the South about rockabilly and be right about it all the time. Right. I'm a rockabilly singer, man. You know what I mean? It's like people don't want to take you serious when you're a rockabilly singer.
And there you got Elvis behind you.
Yeah, man, of course. Got Elvis there. G.I. Blues, baby.
There you go. There you go. So the Japanese government really hasn't gotten involved in this whole.
Yeah, sure. I haven't really. I haven't had the opportunity to speak to them. But, you know, that this is the thing. I'm prepared to defend myself, to speak to people anytime about anything. People can ask me about anything. They can investigate, interrogate, you know, inquire. They can ask me any question. And if anybody says something about me, then like I can sit down with them and speak to them about why I think they're wrong. Even if they think they're right.
I just want, you know, just, I guess, wonder if JPAC ever reached out to the USG. To let them know that they had these South Asian remains, you know, and if they wanted to.
I doubt it. I don't think so.
test the remains against any family samples out of Japan.
Yeah, well, and we can't exactly blame it on JPAC either, because as I said, there was a lot of reorganization within the JTF and within JPAC and the DPAA in the last 15 years. So the time that I found these remains and handed it over to them, in the time between that, there was some bad times for those guys organization-wise, where the organization was split up and then reformed and stuff like that. So all of these, it's not that these remains are with the Joint POW Accounting Command, but, you know, it's been through the agency has been through a lot of changes since we handed those remains over, and there's been a lot more remains found. A lot of people don't figure there's like over 3,000 unidentified sets of remains in Hickam, Hawaii, at the airbase there, at the SIL there, at the lab. So a lot of those guys are from Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran, and stuff like that, Korea, World War II, but there's over 3,000 sets of unidentified remains that they've tried to identify and haven't been able to identify. So Taizo Ishinose and our case is just one small drop in the bucket. But yeah, like maybe it represents the whole bucket in many ways. Our case, it represents a whole bucket. And I don't want there to be any negativity between me and the US government. I'd never have anything bad to say about the US government. But, you know, the US government has been, there's been guys in the US government that have listened to shucksters, and it's been written about in the press. They've listened to bullshit artists who have went to them with this ridiculous negative narrative against me, hit job, disinformation, fake news shit, right? And they've been doing this shit to me for years, man. And yeah, that's it. I just wanted to touch on it, you know, and go over it. I'm just one individual, and I'm not trying to make out that I'm something that I'm not. As I said, I'm a rockabilly singer guy. I'm an artist and former bodyguard. When you say artist bodyguard, people go, "Well, the hell?" You know, usually artist bodyguard, it sounds ridiculous, but it's just the way that it is. I was a fashion designer when I was younger, and a punk rock singer, and then I went into bodyguard work, and then I got into being the MIA hunter. So, being the MIA hunter takes up a lot of time.
Yeah, well, I think we'll carry this little podcast conversation on to other cases too. And
no worries, man.
We'll talk a little bit about it, you know, in the future here. We'll talk a little bit about Sergeant First Class Jerry Mad Dog Shriver and maybe get some of his compadres that he served with on here to talk with us about a little bit about his case. And for those that watch this later, I did a podcast on Jerry Shriver. You can go back into the YouTube and you can listen to it, or on the online or audio podcast on storiesofsacrifice.org. But so what kind of stories do we want to talk about here in the near future?
Well, we have a lot of Sean Flynn things to speak about, and we also have specific cases to go into. We're going to deep dive into a lot of the cases, because there's a lot of cases that you have a lot of documentation on that I have specific information about, or I know some general information about. And so it's going to be interesting. As I said, I know a lot about the history of the Cambodian MIAs, and it's unlike the history of the Vietnamese, the US MIAs in Vietnam, because the Vietnamese, they took prisoners a lot of the time, and the Cambodians very rarely took prisoners. They took prisoners for long enough to interrogate them, to get them to admit that they were CIA spies, and then they were murdered. So, you know, even if a foreigner wasn't a CIA spy, they would have to sign like some confession before they were whacked, after they were tortured, to say that they're a CIA spy. Like, there was a famous Australian yacht guy who had been a roadie for an Australian band called The Bakery, and he was taken off his yacht and taken to Tol Sleng prison and interrogated. And if you read his interrogation, it's... They made up all this, there's all this stuff in there that they wrote, all this ridiculous CIA plot that he admitted to before he was executed. So the Cambodians, they're a completely different breed to the Vietnamese. Their revolution was different, and their revolution was, the Cambodian revolution was guided by and overseen by the Chinese communists, the Maoists. So a lot of the stuff that was going on in Tor Slang, it was actually a Chinese government experiment that they were conducting in their colony over in Cambodia in the 70s. So a lot of that stuff was, well, a lot of these crimes were committed at the behest of Chinese advisors that were in Cambodia.
So, yeah, well, there's also Russian advisors there too.
Yeah, but the Russian advisors were spending more time over on the Vietnam side. You know, that's kind of a line between the Vietnamese and the Vietnamese and the Cambodians. The Vietnamese appreciate Russian communism and Leninism, but the Cambodians don't. They see it as a entirely different kind of revolutionary tactic compared to the Maoism that they practice. So even now, when you have a look at the Vietnam and Cambodian relationship, Vietnam does limited business with China, does a lot more business with Russia, and Cambodia is open business, open slather specifically for China. So yeah, at that time, the Chinese have always had an influence over the Cambodians, and some Cambodians feel like the sun shines out of the backside of the Chinese, and they always have. But that's why there's a lot of Chinese people in Cambodia that are very wealthy as well, traditionally, like Sino-Khmer people.
Right.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, sir.
So, yeah, thank you for letting me check in with you guys here on Sunday afternoon. I'm sorry that I lost a little bit before about some of the nasty things that have been said. Oh,
it's all good, because you know that's the stories that need to be told. You know,
exactly.
It's a cutthroat world out there when it comes to, you know, people trying to make money off of other people's sacrifice. You know,
well, it's the worst thing to do, right? It's like Bo Greitz, right? He was criticized for going out and selling like MIA tour 1979 Thai border, like t-shirts and shit like that, right? So it's the same type of thing. They've tried to compare me to Bo Greitz before and do that ridiculous type of comparison before, but I never had any payday, and I never asked anybody for a payday for this thing. It's just like, don't listen to the real content that this guy's talking about. Whenever he says that, okay, just revert to the talking point and don't answer the questions. Just pretend like the person didn't say it and like walk off or something like that. You know what I mean, John? Yeah, does it sound familiar?
Yes, sir. Yep. Exactly. So, yeah. But yeah, we'll have these regular late night in the US and early day.
Oh yeah. I love it. It's awesome. Yeah, sure. And it's good too. It brings us together. It brings America and Australia together. Oh man. Derek Van Orden. I discovered him through your podcast, and man, he's a hero. He's a legend. And to see that his honorary Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, he got out there and he supported Derek Van Orden. That's incredible. I hope Derek Van Orden gets into the government in the United States, because he's a really good guy.
Oh, he is. Yeah. We got
very honorable guy.
We got five Navy SEALs running for Congress.
And he's down to earth too, man. You see like him at all the state fairs and everything. He's down to earth. You see him there with his US cap sitting next to like a prize cow or something. He's really like down to earth guy.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And yeah. I was also going to say, sorry, John, this is personal, but I was going to say, Mike Pompeo, he looks awesome, man, since he's got into weight loss and exercise. Don't you agree? I've seen the pictures of him. He looks incredible. Like,
he's lost a lot of weight since he got out of government.
Yeah. So yeah, I just wanted to say that you're looking good. Your honorable former Secretary of State. Yeah. And director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Mr. Mike Pompeo. You're looking great. Keep up the good work with the fitness, because you can see like, when I see the way he's changed, it's like similar to when I was big and then I started to lose it. And then you can see it in the face, you know, at first when you start to lose it, you can see you start to get like your face gets some sculpting or sculpture into it or something. Yeah. Sculpting. But he looks good.
You
know. Yeah, so yeah, just before we finish, just I want to send my love out to all the US service people and all of the Australian ones too, and to all the wounded warriors out there that are suffering in silence. You know, suicide is a rubbish idea. We have to support each other and reach out to your mates and your friends. And, you know, like today, this is a dialogue. This is a good dialogue, man, between America and Australia. A very nice. Reputable American and an infamous Australian, nonetheless.
All righty. Well, I'm gonna play this outro and we'll stay on with me because we'll chat for a few minutes.
No worries, John. Cool, man. Alrighty. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, everybody, joining us.
Justin Ball.
Wrong one.
Soars above our land, flag so proudly hailed. Be proud of this America. Realize. Bring our missing men back home, prisoners of war. MIA's America. What are we waiting for? Bring them home. Bring them home. Eagle flies in chains until we have them home again. Eagle flies in chains. That's not all. America, not only bullets kill, the ones we sprayed with Agent Orange are sick and dying still. Can't forget the combat vet. Or wish his war away. His legacy, America, is living day to day. Bring them home. Bring them home. The eagle flies in chains until we have them home again. The eagle flies in chains. War, it seemed so long ago, but Uncle Sam forgets. War's not over for missing men, sick and dying vets. Bring them home, bring them home. Eagle flies in chains until we have them home again. flies in chains. The eagle flies in chains.
Are you in excruciating pain brought on by your son, daughter, or spouse suffering from addiction? The sleepless nights, the constant worry, and the feelings of isolation. Recovery Centers of America wants you to know you're not alone. Addiction destroys families. But if you call Recovery Centers of America today at 1-888-RECOVERY, your loved one can begin to recover, and so can your whole family. At Recovery Centers of America at Capital Region and Bracebridge Hall, your loved one will be treated with compassion and dignity by expert addiction professionals while recovering in a world-class facility. Family support services will give you knowledge, connection, and community so that you can begin to heal and recover as well. Call 1-888-RECOVERY today. Recovery Centers of America accepts insurance, provides transportation, and offers intervention services at no cost. Patients are admitted 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Call 1-888-RECOVERY now.
You know when you order a new video game, or a golf club, or a blender, and then it arrives at your door, you get a little thrill. Imagine how much more thrilling it is when you order a new car. With Nissan at Home, you can shop for the perfect ride and order it without ever having to go anywhere. Sure beats a golf club or a blender. Buy a new car entirely online with Nissan at Home. Deliver direct from dealer to driveway. Thrill starts here. Services may vary at participating dealers, subject to applicable law. See dealer for details.